I guess you could do research.
Sure, certainly.
Gallagher paused and looked Cal in the eye. And your dad is okay with this? Cal was caught. He knew his father didn't want him involved, but on the other hand, just doing some research, that wasn't really being involved, was it? I'm sure it won't be a problem. Okay, so here's a hypothetical. Let's see what you come up with. Pretend that one day the Russians sit down and decide to bring some small nuclear weapons into the United States. Cal blurted out,
You're kidding! That's what you guys are dealing with?
Whoa, hold your horses. I said this was a story, a hypothetical. Got it? Not real life, just a mental exercise. A pop quiz. Cal nodded. So, go along with the assumption. Now do some research on that. Ask yourself, where would they bring the portable nukes? What would their targets be? Show me what you can do.
Where do I start?
Gallagher grinned. You figure it out. You're the straight-A student, aren't you? The former special agent settled back into his sandwich. He figured that he'd placated Joshua's son sufficiently. He liked Cal, but he also knew that Josh probably wanted to keep him out of too much of the sensitive stuff. The assignment he had just given him, the hypothetical, should do the trick. By his estimate, it would keep the kid busy for the next year. Chapter 33 Dr. Korstikov was driving a mid-sized loaner. It had been rented by a third party with an absolutely clean background check, who then handed over the keys to the Russian physicist. Korstikov had flown into Richmond International Airport to avoid Reagan National as well as Dulles, where security was usually ramped up. He was now heading north on Interstate 81, up the western edge of Virginia. The rounded peaks of West Virginia were on his left, and in the distance to his right were the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. In between, straight up the valley where he was cruising in his Ford sedan, was the Shenandoah Valley. The land was green and rolling, dotted with farms, small towns, and horses grazing along wooden fences. It was perfect in its bucolic isolation. The whole county had less than 50,000 inhabitants in its 500 square miles of woods and meadows, minimizing the risk of nosy neighbors. And there were only small local police forces. The state patrol would stick to the interstate and wouldn't be likely to venture into the countryside. Perfect for the final phase of the deadly operation. Korstikov flipped his turn signal and moved onto an exit ramp. After making a careful stop at the traffic sign, he clicked his stopwatch and drove until he came to a small county road. He turned left and drove 2.5 miles until he saw a sign that read Mountain Pass Machine Parts Company hanging from a post. He turned onto the dirt and gravel drive. A quarter mile down the road, he came to a security fence. He reached out the window and tapped in the security code on the pad. The gate opened. Korstikov drove through a wooded area for 100 yards until he came to a metal barn in the middle of a clearing. Several cars and a rental truck were parked outside. Off to the side were 2 long trailers with sleeping quarters. When Korstikov slowed his rental car to a stop at the barn, he clicked his stopwatch off. He read the elapsed time. 8 minutes and 40 seconds from Interstate 81 to the place of assembly. Perfect. He smiled and walked into the barn that housed the assembly shop. They were all there waiting. The Muslim Pakistani scientist who had worked on his own country's nuclear weapons program and had been apprenticed to the notorious A.Q. Khan, the dreaded arms dealer. There was the Canadian transplant from Iraq, who had once been in charge of an electrometallurgical plant, which had been a useful cover for Saddam's fledgling WMD program. Also several technicians who were the nuts, bolts, and wrenches guys who would finally clamp together the updated version of the RA-115 portable nuclear bomb and help load it onto the truck. Last but not least, there were 4 Middle Eastern men with automatic weapons assigned to drive the completed weapon to its final destination. The team broke into applause when Korstikov entered. He smiled and shook hands all around. He stepped over to the empty metal shell that would soon contain the nuke. He placed his hand on the titanium steel casing. In his deep Russian baritone, he began singing loudly and mockingly in celebration of their deadly project and the quiet valley where it would be prepared.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you and hear your rolling river.
The room erupted in coarse laughter. When it subsided, everyone found themselves looking with excitement at the mechanical nightmare that lay on the floor, the nuclear weapon that was awaiting final assembly. In her office in the West Wing, Vice President Tullerud was reading the recent Fed-secure telex message from the Secretary of Energy. It read, "Jessica, heard that you and not POTUS are meeting with Ambassador Portlieva from the Russian Federation. I heard POTUS had a scheduling conflict today. Have you seen the news today? A truck driver in Indianapolis couldn't get gas because of the oil rationing, so he opened fire on the gas station owner and bystanders. 3 dead. This makes the 3rd incident like this in the last 40 days. Hope you can make headway with Portlieva to help us out." Within the hour, Ambassador Andrea Portlieva was escorted into the yellow oval room of the White House, where Tullerud had decided to entertain her guest. It was a classy room, beautifully historic. When the Russian ambassador entered, she flashed a gracious smile and shook Tullerud's hand. She took a sweeping look around at the gold-tinted china on display and the graceful arching walls. "Such a wonderful room," she said with a smile. "And it was, I believe, first used by your president, John Adams, correct? Whose own son was an ambassador to Russia. You're an astute historian." Inwardly, Tullerud was muzzling some mild resentment. The younger, glamorous Portlieva was even more beautiful than her pictures. Tullerud didn't spend much time dwelling on her own looks, except to take the advice of Teddy, her dresser, so she could look both competent and feminine, in his words. She knew she'd never win a beauty contest. But there was another contest she planned on winning, and Portlieva was going to help her win it. After some chit-chat and a cup of tea, Tullerud suggested that they meander over to the treaty room. "Let's discuss," she said, "the possibility of increased shipments of oil from Russia to the United States." As they walked in, Portlieva pointed out the obvious, that Russia had already been generous in diverting certain increased petroleum allotments to help the beleaguered U.S. "Certainly," Tullerud acknowledged, "but not enough. Unlike your country, we've been unable to expand offshore drilling platforms." Portlieva nodded. She understood all too well.
"Yes, ever since your British petroleum disaster in the Gulf so many years ago, followed by all of those most unfortunate political squabbles and another oil spill." Tullerud had calculated that the treaty room would send a message to her visitor, since it was the president's private study. Clearly, Virgil Corland wouldn't be meeting with Portlieva that day. Tullerud would meet with her instead. Corland had no scheduling problem. He was having another one of his attacks and had blacked out. When Tullerud first heard about the president's illness and that she'd have to meet with Portlieva that day, she looked up at the sky and uttered a pronouncement, "There is a God." Of course, she didn't really believe that, but she did feel as if some supernatural force was putting the wind to her back and aiding her advancement. Now, if she could wrangle enough oil from Russia to lift the rationing order on American consumption, she'd be on her way to becoming a national hero. And all that would make her earlier conversation with Attorney General Hamburg even more important. She'd asked him at the time about Corland's absurd order to investigate a possible Russian conspiracy against the U.S. Hamburg had asked her, "Where did Corland's order come from? His fear about the Russians, I mean." Tullerud didn't waste time spitting it out. "It came from that nutcase defense contractor, Joshua Jordan. He met with Corland personally, filled his head with some crazy scenario." "How do you find out?" Tullerud was not about to share the fact that she was using the president's own chief of staff as a spy.
"Reliable source, Corey. Trust me."
"On the other hand," said Hamburg, "I don't want to be accused of countermanding the president."
"You aren't. You can just say that the supposed Russian plot has been looked into and found totally wanting in substance. Period."
Now, as Tullerud sat in the president's chair in the treaty room, with Portlieva in the armchair across the antique oak table from her, she was proud of herself, that she had defused any embarrassing investigation into the Russians. She was free now to really push the oil issue.
"Ambassador, We need a substantial increase in oil imports. We need evidence of further goodwill from Russia.
Portlieva smiled. They talked some more. And when the meeting ended, they shook hands, with the ambassador promising to recommend to Moscow that Talrud's demands be fully met. All the while, Talrud was thinking about her political future. It was bright and beautiful. At that moment, Jessica Talrud certainly wasn't thinking about history. If she had, she might have realized that this was the very same room where, in 1941, President Roosevelt had received an urgent bulletin, telling him Pearl Harbor had just been attacked.
Chapter 34. While Abby traveled back to Hawk's Nest, Joshua had flown to their New York penthouse to get ready for his international trip. He had just finished packing. He wondered where his passport was, but he dug around and finally found it. That was the last detail. He had thanked the Pentagon for offering to fly him to Israel, but had decided to use his personal pilot, Billy, and Jeff, his co-pilot, instead. They had wrapped up the checks on Joshua's own private jet. It was fueled and ready to go. Maybe it was a sign of getting older, but Joshua found his own jet more comfortable than even the cushy ones the top brass used. The doorbell rang. When he swung it open, his daughter stood in the doorway, bag in hand.
"Greetings, Daddy."
Deborah gave him an enthusiastic hug and marched inside. He was about to explain that he needed to leave in a few minutes for his private hangar at JFK, but Deborah jumped in first.
"Look, I know all about the Israel trip."
"Oh?"
"A few days ago, Mom said you might have to fly overseas. Then I just happened to overhear the phone call you got from the Israeli military folks. And last night, she called me and said you were staying in New York getting ready for an overseas trip. I put it all together."
"So?"
"So now that I'll be graduating at the end of this term, I have some time off. 2 weeks before classes start, and... "You know my interests, Daddy. You're doing the kind of work I want to be involved in. National defense, counterintelligence. I couldn't have a better professional mentor than my own father."
"I'm flattered, honey, really. But let's talk about this when I get back."
"I have a better idea. Let's talk about it on the flight over to Israel."
Joshua couldn't hold back a smile. "At least you've got moxie."
"No, listen. This isn't a stretch. It's perfectly logical. It's an opportunity for me to watch and learn while you confer about weapons with a friendly nation. It's the ultimate military practicum. That'll put me heads and shoulders above my classmates."
Joshua pushed back gently. "Deb, you don't have security clearance."
"I don't need one.
Obviously, I'll be excluded from anything top secret.
That's okay with me."
Her father's back straightened and his jaw flexed. "Well, I'm certainly glad it's okay with you."
"I didn't mean it that way. I know I can only attend the non-clearance stuff. Then you can tell me to get lost when the confidential discussions begin. Whatever I can be part of, whatever that means, this would be an unbelievable chance for me."
She took his hand and squeezed it.
"Please, Dad. I really want this."
"I'm not sure it's safe, darling.
I've chosen life in the military. I assume the risk, just like you did."
Joshua took a deep breath. He could take risks for himself, but not for his kids. He looked hard at his daughter. A grown woman. That look of resolve in her eyes. Yes, he recognized that look. It was one of the things he loved about Abby. The soft exterior that covered an iron will. Deb had it, too. So here he was, standing in front of a daughter who was third in her class at West Point and the youngest cadet ever allowed in the program. It suddenly became clear. She was part of the proud tradition. She had earned it. "Deb, have you talked to your mother?" She shook her head, no. Now Joshua had one more thought. There will be hell to pay from Abby. After a few seconds, he looked Deborah in the eye. "You're sure about this?" She snapped back.
100%, sir."
For Joshua, there was only one more question to ask. "You have your passport?" Tehran, Iran. Yosef Abbas was Iranian, but he was also something else, which meant he had reason to be scared. He glanced over his shoulder as he walked. He looked again and again. He checked the plate glass windows of the stores he passed to see if anyone was following him. What he feared was the MOIS, Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security, the dreaded secret police.
He'd gone to the food market near the Vali e Azra, with its pricey shops and little boutiques, to pick up some groceries. But the store was packed with customers, and the lines were awful. Abbas knew how the UN sanctions had made life harder for the average citizen, but it hadn't stopped Iran's plans for a nuclear showdown with Israel. And of all people, he ought to know. Back at his upscale apartment, he sent yet another urgent encrypted email to Rafi, his counterpart in the Israeli Mossad. The last he'd heard, Rafi was in Amman, Jordan, but in the last 24 hours he'd dropped off the radar. Yosef's orders were not to send anything directly to Tel Aviv, too easy for the Iranians to trace. Instead, he was to use Rafi. But the intel that Yosef had gathered simply couldn't wait. He was toying with blowing protocol completely, contacting IDF headquarters at the Kiryat compound in Israel, and letting them know what he knew. Yet for Yosef, this whole thing felt like a bitter act of betrayal. As a proud Iranian, he hated what he was doing. He felt like a traitor, even though he despised that crazy man, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and the Ayatollahs and their ilk. Thinking back, he wished he'd been left alone to study Persian literature and Sufi poetry and teach at the university. That was his passion. But then his brother and sister were captured by the Israelis up in the Golan, spying for Iran, and placed in indefinite detention. Yes, he told them, he would give the IDF what they wanted in return for the release of his siblings and their safe passage back to Iran. What choice did he have? He also cursed the fact that he had accepted a lucrative job as a documents researcher in the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, the AEOI. This made him a useful pawn for Israel. Suddenly, he received a secure text message from Rafi. It was terse. Send pictures immediately using HD encrypt code. Yosef jumped into the chair at his computer and uploaded an array of digital pictures that showed Iran's nuclear refinement facility at Natanz. The photos proved that the site contained missile silos. It seemed grotesquely audacious for Iran to weaponize the very facility that Israel and the Western nations have complained about, and Americans had put under surveillance with a spy plane so many years before. But now Iran's program was complete. The nuclear warheads were armed, and the missiles were being readied for launch. Yosef needed to get his siblings out of Israel before death rained down from the sky. He even thought that maybe if he prevented Iran's missiles from leaving the silos, just maybe he could save not only his brother and sister, but also millions of innocent Iranians who would be caught in the horrors of a full-fledged war when Israel retaliated. Yosef put his index finger down on his computer keyboard and hit send. It was done. For good measure, he double-checked his sent folder. Delivery and receipt were verified. Suddenly, Yosef felt sick with fear. He knew he needed to vacate his apartment and go into hiding. At least for a while. Or maybe longer. Chapter 35. Hawk's Nest, Colorado. Abigail kicked off the meeting.
Everybody's here. Thank you for coming. And those of you on speakerphone, too. You all know that Joshua had emergency business out of the country. He's not free to discuss the details, but he suggested I stand in his chair. No one objected, so here I am. Okay, let's start.
Abigail was seated at the head of the long table in the conference room at Hawk's Nest. A few members, like John Gallagher, were there in person. She quickly cranked the meeting into high gear.
The question before us is whether to take action on the possible nuclear threat that our contact, the Patriot, has explained to us.
He's available to be hooked into this meeting. He's standing by. Senator Alvin Leander, who was there in person, led off. No one was surprised at that, since they all expected opposition from him.
So what verification do we have that our government is standing down on this? I'm skeptical.
Abigail suggested that they loop the Patriot into the meeting by all phone. The group agreed. After a minute, he announced that he was on. Leander asked his question again.
Pat McHenry said, I have it on good authority that Attorney General Hamburg has downplayed the risk. Fort Rice, the retired state Supreme Court judge, was usually the most cautious member of the roundtable. He had flown in from his home in Idaho. What do you mean, downplayed? Define that for me.
McHenry explained. The AG has officially informed all U.S. intelligence and investigative agencies that Joshua Jordan was the source of the information about this possible Russian-North Korean-Iranian plot, and that Joshua is an unreliable source. Beverly Rose Cortez, a Fortune 500 business exec, sputtered through her speakerphone connection.
Josh is a national hero. The president hung a medal around his neck just this week.
But McHenry reminded her of the lay of the land in Washington. Of course, you're right. We all see that, and many Americans do too. But Josh also refused to obey a congressional subpoena last year regarding his RTS design, and then he disobeyed a federal court order. On Capitol Hill, that can make even a hero look like damaged goods, particularly among the top brass in the DOJ whom he thumbed his nose at. Cortez followed up.
What does this mean in practical terms?
It means, Gallagher interjected, that the federal agencies are all going to drop this whole nuclear threat issue into the nearest hole in the nearest outhouse, excuse my French. Phil Rankowitz, the former TV network executive, was also on speakerphone.
What about our running a major media piece on the government's failure to protect Americans? Use our Amerinews service to break the story over the Internet. It's worked before. Our readership is on a tremendous growth curve.
Forget that, General Rocky Bridger growled. We're talking about funding some black ops-type paramilitary action here to stop some bad guys who want to blow us up, right? That's not the kind of thing you blast all over the media,
Abigail said. Let's focus. First question. Do we agree there's a credible threat to American security and American lives?
No dissents were voiced.
Okay, next. Should the roundtable fund and support an effort to counter that threat? Are there any objections?
Leander spoke up. I have no objection, but I do have an extreme caution. I'm feeling incredibly uneasy about this. Rocky Bridger shot out. The question isn't who feels warm and fuzzy.
Silence for a few moments. Then Abigail said. Then, hearing no formal objections,
John Gallagher jumped in. Then we're talking about direct action, tracking down the scum and hitting them hard, inviting the feds to join us, but don't hold your breath. Remember, I saw the changeover at the FBI in the last few years. I was there. From the top down, everything was injected with a big dose of politics, like everybody got formaldehyde pumped into their veins. Abigail addressed Pac McHenry.
Mr. Patriot, what would you need?
My group is effective, but small. We need additional investigative staff, and we need it yesterday. And we need people who are willing to shoot to kill if necessary. And we're also talking $1.5 million, maybe two.
Dollars? Cortez asked.
Right. Gallagher said, I say we get ready to rumble.
Judge Rice wrinkled his brow. He scratched his eyebrow, then lifted his hand to speak.
I'm not sure we are about. What this group is about is hiring private paramilitary operatives within our own country. That sounds like vigilantism. We could be in big trouble for that. Abby, you're not just the temporary chair here. You're also the head of the legal section. What's your take on the ramifications here? I'm already convinced we have criminal exposure.
Abigail leaned forward.
You're right, Fort. A skilled, motivated federal prosecutor could put together a case against the roundtable, against all of us, alleging a conspiracy, using the seditious conspiracy statute.
Fort Rice turned to face the big star-shaped speakerphone in the middle of the table. He addressed his next question to the Patriot.
Sir, whoever you are, one more question. Do you have any information regarding whether the Attorney General's office knows about us?
Yes, they do.
Anything else?
Yeah. There are prosecutors in Attorney General Hamburg's office who want to bring a grand jury investigation into your activities.
Alvin Leander pounced on that.
See? This is exactly what I was afraid of,
Gallagher shot back. Senator, with all due respect, you knew our group wasn't the Rotary Club.
Let me clarify something, Abigail cut in. We will not, I repeat, will not obstruct or interfere with any lawful action of the United States government.
What we are talking about here,
what we're talking about,
Phil Rankowitz jumped in,
is filling in where the federal government has failed.
When they don't show up, and evil is going to happen.
Sort of like the Legion of Superheroes, Gallagher said with a grin. Batman, Superman, flying into disaster scenes to save the citizens when the local constables can't get their act together.
Leander was shaking his head.
Not for me. I didn't join to be some kind of covert strike force. I want change. I want my country back, but...
You're not going to have a country to save, Rocky Bridger shot out, his 70-year-old face purple with emotion, if we drag our heels. For another 4 hours, they debated the issue. The final decision was a compromise. The Patriot was only authorized to investigate the matter further and to make a detailed wish list of what he needed and how much it would cost. John Gallagher said the compromise was a cop-out. Rocky Bridger was also visibly upset. Abigail adjourned the meeting and asked Pack Henry to call her back separately. When he did, only Abigail and Gallagher were in the room. The rest had left.
I want you to know, Gallagher said, that I'm not waiting for the Mickey Mouse Club here to give me the go-ahead. I'm going to figure out something on my own.
Stick with us, John, Abigail pleaded. There's strength in unity. Hang with us.
Speaking of hanging, Pack McHenry said from the speakerphone, wasn't it Ben Franklin, on signing the Declaration of Independence, who said, we must all hang together, or assuredly we'll all hang separately?
And I'm just trying, Abigail said with a struggling smile, to keep every one of us off the gallows.
Gallagher said he had an early flight the next morning, so he'd catch some dinner and retire early to the guest wing with a few of the other members of the round table. Abigail checked her all-phone voicemail when she was alone. There was only one message. It was from Joshua. Honey, we are about to take off. First, want to remind you how much I love you. Thanks for being you. For leading things with the group while I'm out of pocket. Also, how lucky am I to be married to a brainy beauty like you? Not only that, but somebody who's on speaking terms with the Almighty.
Abigail laughed and then teared up a little. She loved the guy something fierce. There was still only one real thing left undone between them, and she shouted it at her all phone.
Oh, Josh, I love you so. But for crying out loud, why don't you just give in to the Lord? Open your heart to Jesus and get yourself radically saved.
But the rest of Josh's message took a strange turn. Also, I have a surprising twist to my trip. A passenger with your same last name. I've decided to let Deborah come along. Thought this would be a great practicum for her. I'm taking responsibility for this, and for her. I'll talk this over with you when I can. Sorry to break it this way. It came up suddenly. Love you like crazy, Abby. You know I'll miss you. Bye. Abby had just taken the roller coaster. Now she was dumbfounded. She marched upstairs looking for Cal. She found him in his bedroom, hunched over his computer. He was scribbling notes on a pad. She had that look of fiery determination on her face, and her son saw it.
Cal, did you know anything about Deb going to Israel with Dad?
He looked up, his eyes wide open.
You're kidding. So she really did it?
You knew?
No, not really. She just said something about how she was going to ask Dad.
Abigail turned away, talking out loud to the air.
And why am I the last one to hear this?
Sorry, Cal said. I thought she was just blowing smoke.
Abigail was wordless for a second, then muttered, Lord, give me patience with that man and with that girl.
Abigail gestured to Cal's computer.
What are you working on?
Just some research. Abigail was still reeling from Joshua's message, so she didn't notice the secretive smile on Cal's face just before he turned back to his project. Chapter 36. Union Beach, New Jersey.
We had to move. Very dangerous to stay in Clifton. Everything had to go.
The Indonesian, armed with an automatic weapon, was trying to explain the change of plans to Dr. Kush Mahikindrani, the team leader for the New York attack. The Muslim nuclear physicist from India, whom everybody called Dr. Kush Mahi, was not happy.
How do I know that the components weren't damaged when you moved our operations?
The Indonesian tried to assure him.
Don't worry. We were very careful. With everything. Promise.
Dr. Kush Mahi looked around the large machine shop. When he had driven to the new location, he scouted out the area. The shop was in Union Beach, New Jersey, not far from the sewage treatment plant. Suitable, but not ideal.
The original plan had been to assemble the small nuclear weapon in a much more remote area in Clifton, just a short drive from New York City. But not now. Union Beach was more than 20 miles from Manhattan as the crow flies. Driving the bomb into the city would be double or triple that distance, and the trip would be across state lines, and the route more complicated. On the other hand, Dr. Kushmahi wasn't responsible to deliver the bomb, only to put it together. The thugs, as he called the armed members of the terror cell, would drive it into the city and detonate it. "I just don't understand the need for the change," he complained. The nuclear engineer from Kenya spoke up in his thick British accent. "I can explain. There was some kind of dispute with the owner of the other building, a problem at the last minute. So they moved here." After looking around, he added, "I think this will do. When I worked on the nuclear missiles for the British submarines, we had a space just about like this. More elaborate machining tools, but we don't need those. Assembly should be fairly simple." Dr. Kushmahi was not impressed. "Arming a nuclear device is never simple." But then he stripped off his suit coat and added, "Let's get to work." They walked over to the crates containing the nuclear components. They inspected the wooden boxes to see if they had been damaged in shipment. The containers were lined with high-grade titanium and synthetic lead, so any real damage would most likely occur if the containers had been dropped and the fragile contents disrupted. Dr. Kushmahi, satisfied that the boxes were not damaged, stood up after his inspection. No reason not to make himself at home, he thought. "Is there any place to get good Indian food?" The last address John Gallagher had for Ken Leary, his old buddy at the CIA, was an office in Washington, D.C., just off Capitol Hill. Gallagher wanted to catch up with him, so he flew into Reagan National Airport and headed into the city. An hour later, as he sat in the back of the cab, he found himself in a traffic nightmare. Some kind of huge rally was taking place on the long, grassy National Mall leading to the White House. "What's the deal?" Gallagher asked the driver. The cabbie shook his head. "Always something going on at the mall." Gallagher saw rows of banners. One said, "One planet, one God, one climate mission." Other banners showed a picture of Romanian Ambassador Alexander Kolikin, along with his now famous quote from his UN address, "The only Earth we shall ever have." When they slowed to a stop, a young man in a blaze yellow vest came up to the cab armed with a stack of flyers. He tried to hand one to Gallagher through the cab window. Gallagher said no thanks, but he did ask the young man what was going on. "We're rallying to support the World Religious Coalition for Climate Control meeting here in D.C. Gallagher, never one to miss an opportunity, smirked and said, "Tell them to set the weather at 70 degrees and clear with a slight breeze. That's my favorite." The man in the vest gave him a funny look. "You really don't know about this?" "Nah, that's why I asked. This is the United Nations initiative on the climate crisis." "Crisis? Give me a break." "Man, where have you been? It's all over the news. The figures just came out. We're on the verge of a catastrophe." Gallagher gave a sardonic chuckle. "Yeah, little do you know." The man kept pitching. "Religious leaders from around the world are here. Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, some high church dude from England. An emissary from the Pope. They're all here, man. And for once, they're all singing from the same hymn book. You know what they're saying? Save the planet. Save the planet." "Funny," Gallagher quipped. "That's exactly what I'm trying to do." When Gallagher arrived at Leary's office, it was empty. No sign of life. So he made a couple of phone calls and then a house call to CIA headquarters in Langley. He discovered that Leary had been transferred to Richmond, Virginia. So Gallagher rented a car and headed south on I-95, crawling through traffic until he was closer to Fredericksburg and the pace picked up. Leary's new office was inside an import-export shop called International Trading Cooperative. He recognized the faux setup and asked the pretend receptionist about meeting with Ken Leary. No, he admitted, he didn't have an appointment. "But Ken Leary knows me, and this is absolutely urgent." After a few minutes, Ken walked out, took one look at Gallagher and scowled, but out of professional courtesy, he invited him into his office. When the door closed, Leary explained, "I got transferred here. I used to be in the New York field office chasing terrorists and managing clandestine offshore operations. Now look at me.
They got me working with Homeland Security, monitoring things like international flights at the Richmond Airport. Leary pointed his finger at Gallagher. And why am I talking to you anyway? You're poison. Slipping you information when you were at the Bureau is probably what got me stuck down here in the first place.
Sorry.
That doesn't cut it. How about this? I'm really sorry. And if it weren't about a suitcase nuke coming into the U.S. within your jurisdiction, hey, I wouldn't be bothering you.
Leary was looking at his wall clock and then shot back.
Oh, so you're really sorry?
Then Leary stopped. He looked up and added,
What did you say?
Gallagher said, I mean, I'm genuinely bummed about what happened to you.
No, no, Leary said, not that.
He tilted his head closer. The other part, about a suitcase nuke.
Chapter 37 Ethan March had tried to connect with Deborah several times, but he only reached her voicemail. He left two messages. They weren't returned. Then he took a chance and called the unlisted number at Hawk's Nest that Deborah had given him. Abigail Jordan answered. She simply said, Deb's traveling with her father, and didn't elaborate. After he hung up, Ethan thought back to his sense that Deborah's mother had some doubts about him. He thought that was interesting, since her husband was the one who had known about Ethan's screw-ups at McGill, and yet Joshua seemed to be willing to consider hiring him. Ethan had even come clean with Deborah about some of his dumber moves. In spite of that, Abigail was the cautious one. Maybe it had something to do with the super-religious atmosphere that permeated the Jordan household, except for Joshua. They prayed before meals. Mrs. Jordan quoted the Bible. Even Cal talked about his spiritual journey at the dinner table. Maybe Deborah's mom only approved of Christian crusaders for her daughter. Things started to add up when Ethan thought back to their picnic. They had traveled by horseback to Deborah's favorite spot. After tying up the horses, they chatted as they ate lunch. Ethan could see that Deborah was different from the girls he flirted with in singles bars. Solid, real depth, a great sense of humor, and beautiful. Oh, yeah. Then the discussion got serious. Deborah looked him straight on. So when you told me about flying that experimental F-35, getting the kinks out, when everything went wrong and you thought you were going to crash?
Yeah, I had my hand on the handle, ready to blow the ejection seat.
And if you did?
Then I'd have been in for an interesting ride. We simulated it in flight school. But when you're up there going Mach 2 and things go south, man, it's really different.
But what I mean is, so you eject, and then your chute doesn't open. What then?
Well, first there's the smaller one, the drogue that opens. Then the main chute.
And if neither one opens?
You die.
That's it?
What do you mean?
Don't you think about dying?
Of course.
Anything else? Thoughts about heaven? About God?
Sure, I guess. But not like you guys. Deb, you call yourself a Christian. You've obviously got a tight set of beliefs. You're really strapped into that. But that's not where I'm at. Then he changed the subject. Got any more fried chicken? Maybe that was a stupid dodge, but the more Ethan thought about it, the more he figured he was who he was. Why change? Now Ethan was driving to the unemployment office in Waltham, Massachusetts, the city he'd called home while he worked for Raytheon. As he drove, a sickening despair overcame him. A feeling of complete mission flameout. The thought of going on the public dole because he was unemployed made him want to vomit. This was for other guys, not him. He passed the office with a sign out front that said Division of Unemployment Assistance. He looked for a parking spot. But then he was shocked by what he saw. The line stretched outside and wrapped around the building. A patrol cop was in the middle of the line, trying to separate two men who were arguing with each other. Ethan slowed down. He eyed the dismal scene of out-of-work America, and then drove away. Forget this, he thought. I've got my pension, some savings. Besides, Joshua Jordan said I might talk to him about working with his company. Of course, Ethan knew the downside, too. He didn't want the job just because he'd helped Jordan's daughter in a crisis. That would make him a charity case. Besides, even if he did get the job, would Jordan, remembering Ethan's wilder days, ever take his eye off him? Would he ever really trust him?
Then the image of Deb's face, her smile, flooded back, overshadowing everything. He wanted to be with her, and he wondered what she was doing right now. According to her mother, Deborah was traveling with her father. Okay, did that mean they were on defense business? Had she forgotten about him? Ethan's feelings for Deb were pushing him back into a familiar pattern, a dangerous one. He found himself wanting to take risks, possibly doing something stupid, just to be with her, wherever she was. Joshua and Deborah, squinting in the glare of the blazing Israeli sun, reached into their pockets for their sunglasses. Standing on the tarmac, they looked around and stretched. Now that the Citation X jet was parked, Billy told his co-pilot to pull the bags out of the storage deck. Joshua glanced at the sign on the edge of the runway. The top half was written in Hebrew, the bottom half in English. Welcome to Ramat David Air Force Base. A host of F-16 fighter jets were lined up at the far end of the field. Across the tarmac, two IDF officers were striding quickly to their location, the younger one carrying a briefcase. Joshua recognized the older one, an officer with stars on his uniform and gray at his temples. He broke into a grin. Aluf Mishnah, Colonel Kinney, Joshua called out, and the two gave each other a hearty handshake. Colonel Kinney then turned to Deborah with a wry smile. You must be Joshua's daughter. Great to meet you. Never mind your father, by the way. He's just trying to impress us with his linguistic skills. He was using the Hebrew term for my rank. Then he turned to Joshua. How much Hebrew do you still remember, my friend? Not much, Joshua said with a chuckle. Shalom and Boker Tov. That's about it. Kinney waved the group toward a large military helicopter that was farther down the tarmac and had just started its rotors. As they walked, he said to Deborah, Your dad might be downplaying his role, but when he was here a decade ago, we worked together on Iranian reconnaissance, his clandestine flyover of one of their nuclear facilities. He spent so much time with us that he started speaking the language pretty well. That's when I first met him. They ducked and climbed into the chopper. Kinney instructed Joshua to sit up front next to the younger officer with the briefcase. This is Major Tikva. He's the operations liaison from General Shapiro's command. He'll brief you on the situation. Joshua responded to the last name of the officer seated next to him. Tikva. Good name. Yes, Kinney said with a nod. Especially for this mission. Kinney reached forward and closed the metal doors. So, Kinney said to Deborah as they sat in the rear seats, you'll be graduating from West Point soon. With honors, I bet.
I hope so, Colonel.
Must be interesting to pursue a military career in the Army when your father's a bona fide Air Force hero.
Well, sir, she said with a smile, you know what we say in the Army.
What do you have when you have an Air Force hero? She paused for comic effect. The bottom half of a real Army hero. Kinney roared with laughter. Josh, your daughter's all right. The big CH-53 transport helicopter took off and started winging its way toward the Negev desert. Deborah studied the dry, tan profile of the Israeli landscape, arid and harsh in places, yet studded here and there with lush fields of green. She turned to Kinney and asked, What part of Israel is the Ramat David Air Force Base in?
Southeast of Haifa, not far from Megiddo.
Deborah's face brightened. She knew about that place.
The Jezreel Valley?
Exactly. We'll be flying over it shortly, Kinney said, then added, As a Christian, you recognize that place, I'm sure. The Book of Revelation, chapter 16. Deborah was dumbfounded. Deborah tried to hide her surprise, but Kinney saw it in her face. Surprised that a good Jewish fellow like me knows the New Testament? And the prophecies of the Apostle John about the final battle of Armageddon, or more literally, Har Megiddo? She nodded. There's a story there. I'll share it with you sometime. Deborah went silent. It was almost more than she could process. As she gazed out the window, she remembered something she had wanted to ask.
Major Tikva's name. My dad said it was a good name, and you said especially for this mission. What did you mean?
Tikva, Kinney said, looking ahead without expression, means hope. Suddenly, Deborah realized the sheer size of this adventure, and wondered what she had really signed up for. She looked down to the valley floor below, with rocky outcroppings here and there, and its trimmed agricultural fields spreading like a greenish-tan tabletop all the way to the mountains at the horizon.
occasionally studded by slender pines and bunches of date trees and palms. This valley. Yes, she had read all about it. She had been taught about it in Sunday school and at her mother's knee. A place of foreboding. But where heaven would finally triumph. Where this world would have its last, most horrific war.
Chapter 38. Krasnodar Krai, Russia. In the Grand Palace of the Russian Federation overlooking the Black Sea, Andrea Portlieva, Russia's ambassador to the U.S., was walking down the marble steps to greet Caesar Demas. He had met her before. The long-legged beauty had always caught his eye. As she greeted Demas and led him to their meeting room, he toyed in his mind with the idea of beginning an affair with her, especially now that they would be doing business together. Of course, he was still married to his wheelchair-bound wife, who, when she wasn't wheeling herself endlessly around their villa outside of Rome, would have the servants drive her to their vineyards in the north. But such a marriage had never slowed his appetite for sexual trysts over the years, including a long parade of expensive call girls. The billionaire's wallet could pay for anything he wanted, whenever he wanted it. When they were settled in the small sitting room, full of black oak chairs upholstered in leather, she ordered drinks. She was drinking vodka. He wanted gin. After some pleasantries, Caesar Demas asked directly, "When?" She replied, "A week. Maybe less." Demas wanted assurances. "Since I will have Russia's backing, I need your guarantee that when that happens, it can't be traced back to Moscow. That would taint everything I have been trying to do. We have been playing this game with the United States in some form for almost 100 years. We've perfected discretion and subterfuge. Be assured, we have an even greater need to keep our hands clean than you do." Demas smiled and gazed into her face. "On the other hand, I can also appreciate a beautiful woman who has, well, less than clean hands." Portlieva laughed. A good sign, Demas thought. He didn't want to negotiate with a prude. He redirected the conversation. "And the new international coalition, the one I have been building. Yes, we still want you at the head. You've earned that. And you have shown a particular ability to forge a solid front made out of divergent nation groups. The European Union, well, that didn't surprise me. But bringing the Islamic nations, the Arab League along with the Asians, and key nations in the African continent and South America. Good work. You've been a busy boy." She sipped her drink and he laughed. He wanted to know more about the United States. "Jessica Tallrud, we still need her." "Of course. I have pledged many millions to her presidential campaign." "She will be an important component, but we are concerned about President Corland."
"His health is failing," Demas said, dismissing Corland with a wave of his hand. "He's a dead man walking. I don't know why he hangs on. There is some conversation about his having a change of heart. In any case, it's good that he won't last. We can't do business with Corland now that he's gotten religion. But Jessica Tallrud, we can deal with. She still thinks he is going to have a dominant role in the coming global coalition. I have been working her from my end. She's salivating to expand her power, not satisfied to be just an American president. She wants to be historic. The first U.S. head of a world government. Behind the scenes, I've promised her that." Portlieva wondered. "After the great unpleasantness happens in the United States, irradiated populations, leveled cities, won't she be forced by her own political party and her own people to fight back, clawing and scratching like a caged animal against the aggressors? By then, the United States will be so weakened, so declawed, that it will be worried about survival, not dominance. Tallrud will be at our mercy. I can play her, believe me. Besides, I think you have done a good job of hiding the identity of their true enemies. The only ones the Americans will be able to identify will be a handful of dead Islamic martyrs. And the American media? What will happen there?
Demas had already calculated that.
Remember 9/11. The American press bent over backward not to be condemning. Editors told their staffs not to use the phrase Islamic terrorist. There's a sizable connection between Russia and the United States. Many folks from Russia and the Baltic republics live in America. The U.S. would not want to be politically incorrect toward Russians now, would they? The same 9/11 media backlash will happen again, but perhaps even more so now. Why, some of the media people may even intimate that it was American foreign policy that caused the attacks against them.
That was a wonderful thought, and Portleva laughed. She reached over to grip his hand.
I think we are going to work well together.
Then she raised her glass. He followed suit. She said, here's to what is coming. The setting of the sun for America's arrogance, and the bright sunrise for the new world order.
Gallagher convinced Ken Leary, which was a major task in itself. What had finally turned Leary's head is when Gallagher mentioned one name that, as it turned out, they both knew in common. Pac McHenry.
He's the source, Gallagher explained, of all my information. They knew that McHenry was doing way out there surveillance for the CIA, along with his Patriot group, strictly as a black ops subcontractor. Much of their work had tendrils into the American homeland, but always with international implications, and usually because they had located a foreign source of aggression that directly threatened American citizens. Was it legal? Not if Jessica Tullrood and her ilk had their way. But the FBI had been gutted by politics and hogtied by insane regulations, many of them now the result of international treaties that the United States had been roped into. Leary was now so concerned that he even violated one of the big commandments. He took his CIA laptop home. He knew he could be fired for that, but what did that matter in the face of this threat?
Gallagher and Leary ordered Chinese food and worked late into the night in Leary's apartment along the James River on the Shaco Slip.
Leary said, look, all I have is the suspicious names on inbound and outbound flights at Richmond International Airport. That's all, John. They won't grant me even a look-see at any of the bigger airports. I've been cordoned off from the rest of the agency.
They ran down the thousands of names on Leary's computer. About 3 o'clock in the morning, they had narrowed the list to three names that fit Gallagher's profile of Russian, North Korean, or Iranian involvement. One was a South Korean journalist with possible sympathies to China. He had flown into the U.S. 3 months before to cover some political news in Washington, but he had left the country for Venezuela. The second was an Iranian diplomat suspected of spying for Tehran, but it couldn't be proven. He had an apartment near Embassy Row in Washington. Gallagher squinted at the last name. He stuck his finger on the laptop screen. Who's that?
Russian engineer. Taught at a technical institute over there. Now he's a visiting professor here, supposedly.
Is that his last name?
Right, Leary said.
Gallagher said the name slowly. Korstikov. Then he asked, what kind of engineering?
Leary typed a search into his computer, then another.
After about 40 minutes, he started nodding his head. Then he nodded more vigorously.
Okay, what's the scoop? Gallagher asked.
It says here he also spent time disarming old Soviet nuclear missiles so they could comply with the non-proliferation treaties.
Gallagher stood up straight. I say we start working on this guy Korstikov, and I mean right now.
Leary was tired. How about a few hours of shut-eye?
You go ahead. I saw an all-night coffee shop down the street. I'll grab a triple espresso. No time for sleep. I got work to do.
Like what?
Superhero-type stuff. You wouldn't understand.
Chapter 39. Cairo, Egypt. Atta Zimler watched the ceiling fan in the little gem shop. He was killing time while waiting for Donkor, the diamond dealer. Donkor was in the back room examining three of the diamonds that Zimler had brought with him. Zimler noticed that the fan was wobbling slightly off balance.
Donkor reappeared through the faded curtain and swept around to the other side of the counter. He laid a soft cloth on the counter with the three diamonds.
"Do you want to know how to fix that ceiling fan?" Zimler asked, pointing up. Donkor rolled his eyes and shook his head.
"Just get a clothespin."
"You have one? I will show you."
"Atta, you know something? You're always trying to remind people how smart you are. I mean, smarter than they are."
The words came out too fast. The gem dealer swallowed. Atta leaned forward, a little too close, and Donkor took a step back.
"Was that meant to be funny?"
"I'm sure you meant it as a joke." Donkor struggled to flash a quick smile, but his lips, suddenly dry, stuck together.
"Of course, you know me, always joking."
Zimler said, "I want to talk business, Donkor. What will you pay me for all these diamonds?" Donkor swallowed again. He shrugged.
£1,000,000. "I said I wanted to talk business. No more of your stupid jokes."
"Atta, I'm sorry, but that is all that I can pay for these." The offer was only a third of what Zimler was expecting, but cash was drying up. Things had become complicated. He could make a clean exit from Dubai with the diamonds with no trail behind. But the pretty girl at the bank window at the Desert Palm Bank gave him an idea. He had wrangled a dinner date with her, then another, this time on his rented yacht. Zimler had figured she knew the bank codes, so he could get to the bearer bonds he knew would be stored there. But she didn't have the codes, and even under torture he couldn't get what he was after. So he ended up killing her and dumping the body. It turned out that the Dubai police were quicker to investigate a missing bank teller than he had anticipated. Once more he was on the run. Now he was forced to return to this jewel fence he had worked with for years, a small-time dealer, but sufficiently black market and extremely well-connected in the Middle East. Donkor stood there, shifting on his feet. He erratically reached out to sweep some dust off one of the shelves behind him. Then he brushed his hands and cleared his throat.
"I don't think you understand the market for these diamonds," Zimler said in a casual tone.
"Oh, no, but I do," Donkor replied. "Diamond market is very different now. All of this blood diamond fuss. Dealers can't afford to just buy and sell. Now there is a big problem because of conflict gems. People want to know where you got them."
"You're not the only dealer."
"Any dealer will tell you the same. Really, Atta, I'm telling you the truth. And in Zimbabwe, Côte d'Ivoire, places like that, it's even worse." Zimler smiled playfully and took a step back, thrusting his hands in his pockets. He was fishing.
"Okay, so you tell me why I ought to take your low-ball price, you scoundrel."
Donkor grinned and loosened up.
"Because I'm telling you the truth, my friend. Look, I'm willing to buy the diamonds. You need the money. Let's call it a deal."
That was what Zimler was waiting for. He leaned forward on the counter and picked up one of the diamonds. He then set it apart from the others.
"How about this one?"
Donkor leaned toward the counter to inspect it. That is when Zimler struck. His right hand flashed out toward Donkor's throat and gripped it. The gem dealer gagged and struggled to breathe as Zimler's powerful fingers closed slowly like an industrial press. Just when Donkor thought he would pass out, Zimler eased up, but only slightly, keeping his fingers locked around his throat.
"Why do you say I need the money?"
The diamond dealer was coughing and gagging. When he could finally speak, he simply said,
"Didn't mean anything by it."
"I don't believe you."
"I know you can kill me. Very strong. But please don't..."
"Why did you say that? Tell me and I won't kill you."
"Just something I heard."
"What?"
"You had some kind of problem. In Dubai..."
"What else?"
"I don't remember."
He squeezed a little tighter.
"What else?" "Just the Caesar Demas thing."
"What about it?"
"He didn't pay you for some job in the States."
"What else?"
"That's all."
He was now satisfied that Donkor knew enough to be valuable. He released his grip.
"I'm removing my hand now."
"Don't you move. Just stand there." Donkor did as he was told, rubbing his neck and panting for air. Then he said meekly,
Atta, I want to do business with you, but not like this. Let's deal with each other, please, like businessmen.
Is this your final offer?
Donkor rotated his head a little back and forth and massaged his neck. He was thinking. Then he said,
In cash, yes. I can pay with Egyptian pounds or euros or the new international credo. Anything you want.
Zimler countered, How about other than cash?
What do you mean?
Zimler was feeling pressed.